What you're about to hear is part two of a two-part conversation with Ed Cook, Grandmaster of Memory, and much more than that. He is a hilarious dude. You will love him. If you didn't catch the first part, however, you might want to do that before venturing in. But this is really a conversation that jumps around, and we answer a lot of different questions and different topics. So if you don't mind your stories as more of a jigsaw puzzle, then by all means, keep on listening. So without further ado, please enjoy part two of The Tim Ferriss Show with Ed Cook. This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multimineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I miss anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
The Tim Ferriss Show.
That was an example of where intuition was thwarted by a kind of banal kind of self-recriminating rationality, resulting in, I'm almost certain, like a less interesting product and less fun.
Now, look, you bring up a really interesting, set of questions. And this is something that, at times I do better with, at times I do more poorly with, but I've tried to, at various points in my life, increase the speed with which I make decisions. So if a decision is reversible and non-fatal, then find my life is generally much better when I just do exactly what you mentioned, which is like left, right, who gives a fuck? I'm going right, it'll be fine. And if it's not, I'll figure it out later. And making these types of reversible decisions as quickly as possible so that you don't have a lot of cognitive burden and you're not sort of stuck up your own ass all the time. But in the case of the bus and the business, let's just say, or how do you balance the intuition, which at some at times can be an irrational exuberance, with sort of prefrontal cortex calculation?
Well, that's a question. That is the question, and it's not a question that I have an answer to. but I assume it's something to do.
God damn it, Ed! Why did I do this interview?
It's pathetic, isn't it? I suppose we're quite far into this interview. There are two things, by the way, we must come back to. One of which is how you think about merit, because how you think about merit, and the other one of which is Burning Man, because I went to that this year, and it is the most perfect example of any institution I've ever seen. And it's also a sublime exemplar of memory techniques put into the outside world. So anyway, so those are two little sort of thoughts which we must come back to. Sure. But where were we? We were I've got no idea about the intuition thing, but like but I think and I'm basically learning from my girlfriend who is a more spiritual connected intuitive person than I am by kind of disposition and native structure, so to speak, who can come to a discussion, you know, and this might get back to our kind of point about relationships, fundamentally with like calm, like with where normally your mind is like, that's normally your mind.
That's actually the best description of my mind I've ever heard right there.
Yeah, and it's kind of rubbish, isn't it? Because you kind of, you know, like, well, one wants to be kind of like a didgeridoo, like the wah 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 wah, you know, whatever. But you know, unfortunately, you're just like, oh fuck, oh maybe I'm a loser. Oh no, I should really like, you know. But by the way, so one thing I quite enjoy about our friendship, Tim, is that you're quite good at like coming up to rational conclusions and implementing them, and I'm not. So earlier this week, I was like, Jesus Christ, I smoke the whole time. I drink lots of wine. I should sort my act out. I'm going to start doing yoga. And even yoga is even something which I find fascinating and interesting, you know, rich. I think it's like a fundamentally profound system of thought, which, you know, connects autonomous rhythms with the body's capacity of movement and the mind. You know, I don't have enough good things to say about yoga, but I never fucking do it. And so I was like, okay, Jesus. I need to be healthy. I was like, I'm going to go do some yoga. And so I went down to the yoga thing and then I paid, they had this big, great deal, £25 for 10 days of consecutive sessions. And I was like, genius. This time I'm going to do 10 days of consecutive sessions. Then went to the first one because I was there and did it, and it was great, and you know, felt fantastic, super pepped up and the rest of it. And that was 5 days ago. I haven't been since. I'm just inept. I don't know what kind of consistency of perspective is required to actually implement worthy plans like that. And actually that's why I quite enjoy chatting and just generally brainstorming with you, because you seem to have a capacity to sort of come up to a conclusion like that. It's like, oh yeah, yoga, really good. I should do some more yoga. And then actually do it. A capacity which I find mysterious and suspicious.
Well, you know, it all comes down to black magic. You have to get a dead cat, preferably black, swing it counterclockwise over your head before midnight. Yeah, yeah. No, it's honestly, I find it endlessly amusing how particularly in some media pieces, I'm played up to be this sort of stalwart of self-discipline and systems thinking. And I function like Bishop from Aliens. You know, I just have this incredible ability to execute. And at the end of the day, I'm just good at setting up incentives for myself that punish me and flog me if I don't do things. So the way that I would conquer the yoga has nothing to do with convincing yourself or rationalizing. I would take extremely unflattering photos of yourself in tighty whities front and center, give those to a friend who can keep an agreement, but who will also show no mercy, and just say, if I don't prove to you as my judge that I've gone to yoga for 10 days straight, like these are going to go, you know, on the homepage as a pop-up or something like that, or on Facebook.
You know what this connects with? This is a bit like Goethe and his friends in the room. It's like externalizing beyond yourself the sources of the things you need for yourself.
Yeah.
A bit. Yeah, I mean, that would be a pompous way of saying it, obviously, but...
No, but I think self-discipline is so overrated. If you break it down, you know, self-discipline is actually, it's kind of a poor label. It's poorly defined, at least. It's overused to the extent that it's really lost any type of clarity in its meaning.
Yeah.
So for me, self-discipline is like, no, we're like rats in a lab. Put us in a Skinner box, which is life, and we respond to inputs that are punishment and reward, and we adjust our behavior accordingly. So it's like, all right, great. Well, make that external. You're not going to punish or reward yourself typically. It's usually not enough, and it's right. too easily reneged. So you can uh-huh. you can externalize it. You can also put some money on the line. That's also very useful for people. But but how the hell did we get this far? So the we're going to talk about Burning Man. We're going to come back to your discussion with your girlfriend, which we left long ago, mm-hmm. but we'll come back to that. Then merit. So merit, I'm still struggling with this, and I'm a bit of a semantic pain in the ass. Is merit close to the in your mind, sort of the Roman arete, like this virtue, or is it just can it be boiled down to sort of deservedly winning? Is that
well,
what?
So yes, so I think virtue, of which I have none, but virtue is like I think is the correct is how we should think about merit. So you know, in some sense, the humanities, inverted commas, have had this nailed for like 2,000 years. What like the fundamental tendencies of a good human being are, you know, empathy, temperance, generosity, kind of non-egotism. You know, we sort of know what good human beings are, and we have done for thousands of years. But that's not what we celebrate or immediately associate with merit, right? So we tend to associate merit with like tangible outcomes in life path, mm-hmm. Which might include like getting a Harvard law degree or, you know, being Bill Gates or whatever. And so the kind of the concept of improving oneself is obviously an excellent concept, regardless of how socially you perceive human action and existence, because to improve yourself is to improve the world. It's to improve your interactions with others. It's not a kind of lonely activity, but at the same time, you know, if you look at like, you know, Silicon Valley startups, which are, in some sense, the great drivers of human culture at the moment, besides like ISIS and whatever. But like, anyway, but you know, the natural tendency in that way of thinking is to become personally more efficient. Mm-hmm. So it's to like store files more effectively, get things done better, do, you know, be quicker, optimize oneself, and this is a kind of merit thing in its way. But it's quite a selfish one, goodness knows, you know, for lots of subtle reasons, we're all selfish. But you can imagine an alternative culture of creativity and power of the kind that Silicon Valley has, which would all be focused on making communities better and institutions better and hacking not oneself but the situations which comprise the world. And you know, I'll give you my kind of go-to example about this is you go to San Francisco, unbelievably cool town, full of just the most magical people, so like intellectually vibrant and open and fun and awesome and beautiful, but so rich, and there's fucking like homeless people everywhere. And you're like, seriously, guys, that's Twitter HQ there. It's a $15 billion company or whatever. Everyone inside is being paid more than $100,000 a year. And this happens on their doorstep? Do they have no, like, conception, no, like, basic grasp over what, like, happy existence is? Because your existence would be happier if you didn't have to, at a purely selfish level, walk past all these people who were clearly in a state of distress and maybe hassling you and whatever. Anyway, so I think that's like, that's one of the most interesting things about San Francisco. And it's kind of, to me, emblematic of a tendency of thought which looks to optimize the individual over the situations qua your like external stuff influencing the self rather than the self influencing the self, rather than external situations, which are the things which actually make us happy, like the ability to play chess on the street and, you know, giving people things and whatever other.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that just to not take us down too much of a political rat hole, but I think that the part of what makes San Francisco very fascinating and the Bay Area in general is there are many divergent opinions on many different subjects. And some people think Bitcoin is a fraud. Other people think it's the future. And there's everything in between for every conceivable subject. Some people believe in long-term monogamous relationships, and then you have the whole polyamorous community, and there's everything in between. Simultaneously, for instance, I think that San Francisco could learn a lot as it relates to homeless people and other aspects of rejuvenating a city from New York City. I think Giuliani and Bloomberg have done just a phenomenal job with converting Manhattan into a pleasant place to walk. And that wasn't in the distant past that it was terrifying to walk in areas that are now very popular. The challenge, I think, is that in San Francisco, among many, there are many reasons for this, but one of the challenges is, I'm sure maybe you've heard the expression, you know, a liberal is someone who doesn't know to take his own side in a fight, that in San Francisco, there's such a divergence of opinions. No one can agree on fucking anything. And, that makes it very challenging to deal with systemic issues that involve a lot of people. But yeah, I agree with you.
I wonder if that's really right, Tim, because, like, you know, there was lots of consensus in San Francisco in certain regions of life, right? So, you know, the whole kind of entrepreneurial ecosystem is so fluid and dynamic because everyone agrees how it should work. You know, you got the venture capitalists, the entrepreneurs, the talented young guys, the angel investors, and there's like a very kind of clear shared set of concepts about, and also a lot of generosity and consensus. Everyone's always helping everyone. You know, there's no overt selfishness at all, really. You know, it's like that's what I describe as like almost a perfect harmonious community where people are like doing amazing things, trying as hard as they can, but. You know, I for instance, like memorize one of the rival sites to memorize in some sense is this site called Quizlet. And I'm incredibly good mates with the CEO of Quizlet, this guy called Andrew Sutherland, who's a terrific character. And it's so striking on meeting him. You know, we see each other, we have a wonderful time together, and we brainstorm together, and he helps me wherever he can. And there's a kind of a sense of shared journey, which defies any notion of normal competition. And that's the kind of thing which is going on in the entrepreneurial community. And yet, there are these quite, you know, radical divisions between that and, you know, for instance, I don't understand the history of the homeless people, but it is striking that there are, you know, so many of them and that these two worlds coexist spatially, but have zero social or emotional or conceptual connection in a way.
No, I agree. I think that it's very easy to succumb to the belief that SF is tech or that the Bay Area is tech when in fact that perception is because of the prominence in the media and otherwise of outliers. And that the sort of sexiness and romance of building multi-billion dollar companies in short periods of time has created a misperception, I think, of how much of the population benefits from being employed at tech companies. I think it brings up kind of an interesting question. Maybe we won't get into it right now. I want to talk about Burning Man a bit, but that cool. There are a lot of people in Silicon Valley and in New York City and all over the world who struggle with the question of, should I give back now? Should I try to create positive karma in the world and benefit others now? Or should I be completely selfish now so that I can be completely selfless later? So for instance, there are people I know, and this is going to sound crazy, who would argue that, you know, Mother Teresa is a media hound and she should not be looked at as a saint, and that it would be better to look at someone like Bill Gates, who is, you know, not exactly the nicest kid on the block when it came to competition and ruthless capitalism for a long period of time, but who now, with the stroke of a pen, can wipe out, ostensibly, you know, wipe out malaria or polio. Mm-hmm. And that we live in a culture where the former has been romanticized, because it's easier. Yeah, perhaps it comes back to like general mental functioning. It's easier to, for us to take this archetypal image of a saint in our mind, as opposed to the more complex narrative of somebody who, like a Jobs, for instance, who's kind of a son of a bitch, if we really look at it objectively, who's now being deified. And how do you...
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, sorry to interrupt your question, but I think Gates is a really...
if that was a question, that was the longest question of all time. I think it was just a, rant, so go ahead.
You know, I assume since it's probably past 3 p.m. in San Francisco that you've moved on to the gin and tonics, and that's but I think Gates is a good example because Gates is deified, you know, is considered a heroic figure because of this sort of this generosity after the fact of wealth accumulation, I had quite big arguments with close friends about this, because there's one perspective which says, A, Gates, through personal merit, accrued $60 billion and so deserves to be able to spend it. And B, he's this like hyper-competent character who's much better than some like inept, internally strife-ridden charitable institution who aren't going to get anything done. This guy's got the competence and the rest of it to go and solve the world's problems unilaterally, and he'll get it done really efficiently. And I can kind of see the merit in that type of kind of perspective. But here's another perspective, which would be, so Gates exploited probably pretty illegally monopolistic practices to accrue from the population of the world immense undeserved wealth at the expense of their computing experience. And now, as a unilateral actor, he now has the opportunity to spend this on whatever he feels is right, where in fact, it shouldn't be Bill Gates's decision what humanity's wealth gets spent on to sort out problems. That should be a democratic process. Gates, that old phrase, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, I think is kind of fundamentally psychologically real. That's actually kind of an aside, but you know, I would like to see, as an alternative history of 1980 to 2010, I'd have liked to have seen Gates become very rich in the course of the 80s and spend $50 million on his local community. And 1,000 people around the world, or everyone around the world, have a much better computing experience. And 1,000 or 1,000,000 people around the world have the opportunity to divert their fraction of the great sum he has at his disposal to the situations in their local communities or in the broader world, which they judge to be meritorious. To merit this sort of spending. And and the extreme way of saying that is like Gates is basically the last person on earth you want spending this kind of resources, because he is I think he's quite a likable character. because nobody should be spending $60 billion. There should be like 60 million people spending $1,000. There's something fundamentally wrong with our institutional structure. And, you know, and to the objection that it's just not as efficient as when you've got a big head honcho just like calling the shots, that's probably true. But efficiency on both sides of the equation, i.e. the charitable side and the wealth accumulation side, seems to be a very ambiguous good, right?
Well,
more efficient.
I don't want to beat the dead horse too long, but one of the ways my thinking has flipped in the last few years is related to judging prioritizing intentions or outcomes. So what I mean by that is, as relevant to this conversation, is, you know, would you rather have someone who in their heart of hearts is pure, I was going to say as pure as gold, but that's not really, doesn't make much sense. But you get the idea. Someone who is truly altruistic, who has the greater good in mind with $1 million, or someone who is at their core Scrooge, but who out of guilt, to absolve themselves of guilt, is going to behave as if they are altruistic with $100 million. Which would you prefer if they're of equal intellectual capacity, right? So their ability to problem solve is equal. And now I think I would probably opt, if I'm just focused on outcomes, fixing aspects of the educational system, fixing healthcare, whatever, global literacy, whatever it might be, I'm happy to take the extrinsically motivated rich guy as opposed to the intrinsically motivated less rich guy. You know what I mean? If I'm just looking for outcomes, because I used to, and that doesn't mean don't give back. I think there are many arguments that could be made. And I wrote a blog post for people interested called The Karmic Capitalist, about my thinking on this. But, let me ask you just to sort of take us, in a related but slightly different direction. Because I'm probably more, I'm not a Randian.
By the way, exactly. This is the moment to bring in Burning Man, by the way.
Okay, because, bring it in. Bring it in.
Yeah.
Can I ask you one other question? And it's going to be a long answer, we can come back to it. But I want to know what is financial security to you? Where does money fit into your life?
Well, I think it's very difficult to starve in Northern Europe.
Meaning it's unpleasant when you starve, or it's difficult to end up starving.
It's just like, yes, by 2014, people were of the opinion that starving in Northern Europe was actually quite unpleasant. In 2007, starving was great fun. I meant that, like, we are blessed a bit with what the low bar is in terms of life outcomes. Starving doesn't really happen in Western countries, although of course there's lots of tricky kind of situations which get close to that. But it's funny actually, because I actually am not sure if I have a totally kind of honest internal perspective on this, Tim. Part of me is like, to be honest, I'd be perfectly happy just schlepping around Europe, chatting to people, having the odd espresso and just generally experiencing the world. But what I actually care about is conscious experience and understanding and, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, I do enjoy a good party and, a nice home and so on. And, I also quite enjoy like sitting, in front of one of my dreams. It's funny, dreams, you have dreams all the time in your life. And, when I was 5, I wanted to be a carpenter. When I was 6, I wanted to be Beethoven, whatever. Some of them stick with you. And one of the ones that's just stuck with me is a mixture of exactly this blend between, like, I don't give a crap about money and I basically want to live in the kind of utopian situation which can only be sustained by enormous private wealth. And this dream is that I've had it since the age of 15 and it won't go away, which is that my idea for what I really want to do in my life is to have a philosophical academy in Greece. What I'm seeing is like, Mediterranean sunshine, beautiful people in white robes, people playing guitar on the beach, a kind of network of pavilions. You'd sit in one for a while, just contemplating the meaning of the color green for like 6 weeks. And then you kind of wander up the arcade of columns by the swimming pool with all the beautiful people and have scintillating intellectual conversation. And you'd somehow be apart from the world of ambition and, trying to sustained progress, and you'd be sitting back and contemplating the concepts which normally drive our, you know, our intentions, and you know, you just basically be having a good old think about what the meaning of it all is. But also, you'd be surrounded by beautiful people in great luxury and sunshine. so it's like right here is like a conflict, and so certainly, like, I hold in contempt the idea of counting score in life through wealth, and there's fairly small evidence to me. In fact, I just go with the accepted evidence that up to a certain point, it's great to have some resources because it allows a certain level of relaxation, comfort, and kind of sustainable existence in the world. But beyond that, it's kind of vanity and stupidity to pursue worldly resources. But, you know, funny enough, random thing. Aristotle is really funny as a moral philosopher. And one of his one of the reasons he's funny is that he doesn't really believe you can be happy if you're not beautiful. Which is kind of probably true, but, like, you know, we don't dwell on it. And anyway, he's also got
not a popular advertising campaign.
Yeah, exactly. And he's also got like a virtue which is only available to the rich. And his virtue system is kind of is about poles. Like, for every virtue, there's an extreme exaggeration of that virtue, which becomes a kind of a sin or a vice. And there's a thing in the opposite direction, so not enough of it. And so one of his virtues, only available to rich people, is magnificence. And so he thinks that the correct use of the energy that is wealth is to be magnificent, which is to say, to throw amazing festivals and build awesome buildings and foster great artists and do this kind of thing. And then that can go in its extreme form to ostentation and sort of vanity, you know, sort of like the kinds of characters, I think, who are, you know, who occur wherever there's extreme wealth, you know, Russian oligarchs being the classic contemporary example, or towards miserliness, where you have all this wealth and you're not organizing any parties. What the fuck? You know, and I think that's probably, like, you know, it's probably orthogonal, but it's probably a quite good way of thinking about wealth, which is that there is a responsibility to create joy. And there is a responsibility to, and there's nothing inherently sinful about being wealthy or whatever. But anyway, going back to this academy, to which, by the way, Tim, you're going to be hugely welcome. I hope you're going to hang out there very often. You know, I think it's going to be really cool. We're just going to sort of just hang about and chat about stuff.
Yeah. Well, and, green, you know, green is also my favorite color. So I have a lot to ponder there.
Okay. Yeah, good. Yeah. Interrogate yourself about that. You know, favorite. I mean,
I think the use of riches is an interesting segue to Burning Man, because there's a lot of discussion about this, of course. But tell me your impression of Burning Man. I'll leave it wide open since you brought it up.
Yeah, I did bring it up. And, so, I mean, I love parties, and so I wanted to go for Burning Man for a while. My best friend Al is often at Burning Man, and so eventually we got it together. We went to Burning Man. And Burning Man is an absolute ordeal to get to, especially if you're coming from the UK. So you've got to get to San Francisco. Then there's all this, like, you've got to purchase lots of objects and water and snacks and costumes and all this stuff. And then you've got to do an 8-hour road trip. And about 4 hours into the road trip, you're like, wow, this is getting pretty much into the middle of nowhere. And then you keep on schlepping on and whatever. You get there and then you spend 4 hours in a queue in a dust storm or whatever. Get to the gate. And then some, like, slightly sort of annoyingly kind of enlightened looking character says, like, welcome home. And you're like, fuck off, mate. I live in Hackney. I've come to a music festival. Anyway, like, in between that and leaving Burning Man, something happens where, as you're leaving, you're like, well, he was right. This was my home. And so what's happened in between? And so, and what's interesting is that I was not indoctrinated into the quite sophisticated kind of moral conceptual framework around Burning Man, all their principles and so on. I was just sort of going along for a good party. But here's, like, my kind of quick fire theory about why Burning Man is the most brilliant institution I've encountered. and is the first evidence I've seen that, oh, not the first evidence, whatever, but is a compelling case for why Silicon Valley is actually a culturally important place on a par with, say, the Renaissance in Florence or something, where, like, if you look at the buildings in Silicon Valley, you're like, Jesus, these guys, may build good software companies, but they sure don't know how to live. You know, just like, you know, it's like the car park. You're like, you know, anyway, so why is Burning Man so good? So there's no money, which cuts out one fundamental aspect of your social relationship to the world. There's basically no time, because no one's got a watch on them, and no one would care if they did. Although there is time, but it's a different quality of time. It's basically the rhythm of sun and night. And then there's no mobile phone. So no one is basically able to connect with their normal, unbelievably banal set of preoccupations. And as a result, people are kind of stripped down. So you got no money, no ambition, no obsession with what you're supposed to be doing. And there's basically no agenda whatsoever as regards what happens. And it's long enough, about a week, that, like, unlike a kind of UK festival, of which there were many great ones, including things like the Secret Garden Party, at the Secret Garden Party on the Saturday, you're like aware that on Sunday you're going to have to pack up and go home. But at Burning Man, the temporal horizon is just long enough that basically it might as well be infinite. You're just like, I am here. So that's the first thing. It's like you're stripped away of a lot of the kind of tendencies of interaction, which normally kind of make you basically a fucking boring person. And then the second thing is that it's you kind of bounce around Burning Man, and it operates, as far as I can tell, at four scales, which interweave in this kind of fractal way. So you've got like camps. So you've been in Wild West camp, and you're there in Wild. You know, at one point, I found myself playing a piano naked in a Wild West bar, surrounded by Frenchmen singing the French national anthem. You know, it's sort of basically a quite undistinguished way to be spending 20 minutes of your life. But anyway, so you're in the Wild West, and you're feeling kind of like you're in the Wild West. And then, you know, an art car go past. You wonder how you get on the art car, and the art car buzzes you off somewhere else. So the art car is kind of the second order of magnitude. You're in the Wild West, feels like the Wild West. You're kind of open because you're not thinking about money or time or what you're supposed to be doing or your career or like how you really want to achieve this by next year. But unfortunately, this is getting better. But all that's cleared out. And so, I could get on the art car. Art car's one order of magnitude scale wise down. And the art car might be like a fish or a boat or whatever. Get on the boat. And then you're living on a boat, you know, and the whole vibe is boatish. So you've entered a different world. And then you talk to a person on the boat, sort of third scale of spatial organization down. And the person does not have an agenda, because they have basically completely forgotten about all the things which preoccupy them normally. And so you get further in about 5 minutes of conversation than you do with a flatmate in about a year, because, you know, you just say, how are you feeling? It's like, oh, not so good, because of, you know, the sort of thing which no one would ever tell you normally. And then, you know, where are you from? And then because you're really open, because you're not thinking about your money or your time or the things you have to do, you're like, oh, well, actually, the fact that you're from Wisconsin and a little farm is kind of interesting in a way which it wouldn't be according to my normal filters. And of course, none of this is rational. It's just a kind of intuitive flow. But so you have very rich, and so people are their own worlds, which you dive into. So we've had the camp, where you're like in a world, and then you've got the art car, which is basically like kind of floating nightclubs. But anyway, you got art car, and that's kind of a world, and then a person is the world. And then it's got this gift economy where the gifts are themselves their own world. So sometimes it's like, you know, a little object which expresses some profound story about this person's life or about the world or anything else. One person, and I should add, since we're on record, that I didn't indulge, was like, this, my friend, is one of only 10 DMT inhalers in the entire world. So that would have been a world to dive into as a gift. Anyway, so, and because of the lack of temporal horizon, you kind of bounce between these spatial levels. You're in a camp, you're talking to a person, you're like on an art car, you're done, and you cease to kind of track how they relate to each other. So the whole thing has the character of a kind of an external hallucination, where one fascinating piece of the world will pop up and dissolve into the next fascinating bit of the world. And there's no attachment, and there's no nothing kind of thing. You're just bouncing around this extraordinary experience. And as a result of that, quite fundamental concepts change. You know, you're like, you know, your relationship to the distinction between a nightclub and a piece of art dissolves. Your concept of what a friend is and what someone you don't know is blurs, because everyone's kind of a friend. And of course, like, this all sounds quite pompous, but you're also having a terribly good time. this is really striking, because I was not indoctrinated before going there.
Right.
And within 2 days, I was living in this kind of magical invented thing where what was so striking was that it was all based on giving and generosity and openness and transient creativity. And the structure of the party, if that's what Burning Man is just of unbelievable genius. I mean, I was staggered. I love parties. I studied it. You know, I once tried to write a book about house parties, actually. It wasn't very good, and I never completed it. But you know, I love parties. And I'd never imagined a party could be like a dance in the brain of a philosopher or something like that. It's like, and it's really like, it's a way of like, it's a party which kind of gives you insights into totally different ways of relating to yourself and the world. And I love the fact that it's transient, because A, it means that only through the proactive participation of the people who are involved will it ever exist. But B, it means that the meaning has to go outside into the world in a way. So, you know, you don't go to Burning Man and there you have your like isolated kingdom, like my philosophical academy in Greece, for instance, where you're kind of denying the world and then living your own private dream in a kind of onanistic kind of nonsense. It's actually just like an opportunity to reconceive stuff and then go back to the world and then like think, oh fuck, well, just like Burning Man, the world is a consequence of the actions of everybody who's in it. Just like Burning Man, any form of relationship is possible. You know, just, you know, whatever. And so it's fundamentally a mind expanding thing. And although I have no knowledge of this whatsoever, it seems to me to be intuitively very plausible that, the kind of genius of Silicon Valley, the kind of the fact that it's creating experiences and possibilities of life, which genuinely touch upon, you know, the transformation of humanity in subtle ways at the moment and bit by bit and iterative, of course. I can only assume they are somehow connected.
No, so I have a challenge for you. Well, the first is a recommendation. I think you'd really enjoy a book called Spectacle by David Rockwell and Bruce Mau, MAU. It's basically a visual compilation, essays and photographs that look at the phenomenon and history of massive public performances or events around the world, which is really just a phenomenal tome. The challenge is, and this is something I've thought about, because I wouldn't say agoraphobic, but because I'm intrinsically quite introverted, I've been to Burning Man twice. I enjoyed it. I end up spending a lot of time in my own camp, partially just to recharge. If you were tasked with creating, as much of the benefits that you derive from Burning Man with a group of 20 people on your own, so you're creating your own experience to provide many of the benefits of Burning Man for 20 people, what would you do? How would you do that?
That's a super question. Okay, so of course, in some sense, I'm just going to make up whatever I want to say.
No budgetary constraints.
but let's just sort of do it with that, with my little theory there about why Burning Man is so cool. Let's just apply that to 20 people. So, a massive hero narrative road trip to get wherever you're going. So you're like spatially and experientially separated from your boring life. Mm-hmm. No phones. No money, no motivation to talk about your intentions in the world, but more just sort of open thing. A shared creative project where you somehow like spontaneously democratically come up with a cool way of making everyone else happy, you know, perhaps collaboratively in this other space, and then enough time to be to not be worried that it's going to end tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so just like riffing on this, just like thinking of it, you know, what we should do is, you know, what we might do is collect the crew. Some, I think with 20 people, it'd be good if they're like some are known to each other, but it was kind of a mixture of groups of friends or whatever. Agree on like some random distant point. Okay, we're going to go to the Hebridean Island for a week. I'll see you there on the 3rd of January next year. Whatever. Right. It's miles away or what have you. And then, then just go there minus mobile phone, blah, 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 blah. And just rejoice, I guess, in the fact that, like, people are so cool. Which is kind of thing which I'd oddly rather forgotten before Burning Man. I was just like, oh, people are so annoying. They're always like in the queue in front of me while waiting for the bus and like, you know, etc. But like, you know, of course this blends quite easily into sort of cults.
Right.
Which is why having a participatory not driven by concepts experience is quite important. I mean, I suppose one of the paradoxes, bearing in mind, that it is driven by concepts in a sense, like there's this concept of radical self-sufficiency and of generosity and so on. But you know, I've got a party in mind. I mean, you know, I think that, you can hardly fail to have a good experience if you're with 20, like, generous, open people with loads of time away from your life. And you're feeling great about yourself because you're in the middle of a hero narrative because you actually successfully got there. And this could probably be done with two people as well.
So I've thought about this. I've thought about doing it in a wilderness setting, primarily in my own head, sort of recreating the elements of...
Your head's not a wilderness, Tim.
Yeah, of Burning Man. There's a project you might find interesting or people listening might find interesting called... Station to Station, and there's a guy named Doug Aitken, Aitken, and he basically packed this, I think it's 11 cars, I'm making up the numbers a bit, but 11 cars of a train full of musicians and artists and all sorts of craziness. I mean, think about it as sort of Burning Man on a train, and went from city to city doing these massive pop-up performances where they would take these... abandoned buildings or old train stations and turn them into concerts for one night and then pack up and move on their way, which were called nomadic happenings. Pretty cool stuff. How do you take the experience of Burning Man and create more of those peak experiences, if you want to call them that? What are other ways of pulling your head out of the mundane bullshit and doldrums that constitute the vast majority of most people's waking existences?
I mean, great question, you know, and not one I've really successfully answered for myself, but but I'm more than happy to advise about it. Yeah. I mean, I think it is a fundamental question, and I think that many of the our kind of inherited cultural tendencies are like this a bit, you know, like one of the best parties I ever went to was like a moon celebration, and it was on a cliff and the sea was like formidable and raging beneath, and it was all night, and it was a full moon, and the tide over the course of the night came up, and there were kind of crazy ritual dances to celebrate them. it was pretty eccentric. But I tell you what I came out of that with was I was like, oh, fuck. The moon and the tide are connected. And of course, like, I'd learned that as a 5-year-old schoolboy and not understood it in the interesting way. The interesting way to understand it is to perceive the moon and perceive its pull on the sea in real time, to actually, like, feel in your bones the connection between these two things. And anyway, so that was a kind of a really cool thing. And I guess it kind of gets back to like commonality, I guess, commonality between people, which is that being yourself is quite a fun thing. But it's not quite as nice as noticing that you are like an instance of humanity, and that everyone else is kind of basically the same, and actually so are the animals, and in fact it's all matter and whatever. And you know, and it's kind of paradoxical thing that when you perceive in your bones your own insignificance, you feel better.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good way, that's an astute way to put it. That's very true. When you're less concerned with all of the just the minutiae and bullshit in your life that is really at the end of the day very trivial in the span of history and the scale of the world, you feel a lot better about it.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Like I had this when I was at school, like occasionally I would like, I don't know, I would lose a debating competition or like discover that I was a loser in a more general sense. And I had like a what you might kind of call in a way like a mind hack, which, you know, I'd be sitting on the loo or something and I just think about like, oh, everything feels terrible and awful and it's all gone to shit sort of thing. And then I'd be like, but if you think about it, the stars are really far away. And then you kind of try to imagine the world from the stars. And then you sort of zoom in and then you'd be like, oh, this is tiny little character there for a fragment of time, worrying about, you know, it's just like, just take a chill pill. It's all, you know, but you know, like it's, you know, to your question, how to put that into your life. I don't really know. It's really tricky, but I guess, another thing is to, to try and draw this back is to segment a little bit, you know, to make sure there's one day a week where your mobile phone's off and to make sure that, you know, with your best friends, you find a time, whatever, once every 3 months to update them on just how stupid reality is and to share that. and that, you know, if you're in a relationship where like you kind of, you're, you know, the struggle of like existence is kind of occluding the parallel magic of what could be happening there, you at least occasionally find the time to do that, you know, whatever. And of course, there's, I suppose the more fundamental suggestion would be to like stop trying so much.
Right.
which, you know, I mean, like tricky, you know, yeah. Because, you know, one's got such an interesting project, you know, like, but I've got this wonderful friend called Paul, who's like, you know, one of the most kind of intelligent people I've ever met. And, very, that's right. Anyway, he lives. So when I was talking to him about the academy, the Greek ideal of my kind of imaginary possible future existence, he was like, well, you know, why does it need to be in one place? And I was like, oh, it's true. It could just be, you know, in the world. And then he was like, and why does it need to be with the same group of people? And I was like, oh, well, it's true. You know, like updating the people is quite good fun. And then he was like, you know, why does it have to be in sunshine? Why can't it be in a mixture of things? And I was saying, it's true. Like, I quite like rainstorms and, you know, Nordic climates and so on. And then kind of almost went further. Just like, you know, why does it even need to be outside of your life at all? and he lives a life which is very humble in a way, but quite profound in another, where, you know, he travels. He works an absolutely minimal amount. He's so clever that he can sort of do like 5 hours of translation a week and survive, you know, like whatever. And, you know, he learns languages and he falls in love with people. And he watches amazing music and he has the most incredible network of friends. I mean, I feel he's one of my best friends and he probably feels I'm one of about 100 because he spends 10 hours a day on friendship, you know, and, you know, when we're in the middle of that conversation, I was like, ah, Jesus Christ. I'm just like, you know, I'm just guilty of grandiose fantasy where it's, you know, the life I'm desiring through these concepts, or whatever, is actually just, it's right there. It's something which I could be living if I would only see sort of working 12 hours a day in a startup.
Yeah, it's very hard, that balance. I even hesitate to use the word balance, but it's challenging to balance the appreciation of the present moment with the drive to build things, because the people who tend to spend, quite apart from that, we could debate the value of building different things, but the people who build the most very often have the least present state appreciation, and the people who are entirely in the present moment don't build very much. So you could argue very strongly for both ends of the spectrum, but trying to borrow the best practices from both is challenging. And maybe the answer is that you oscillate between the two. I don't know, but.
It's interesting. I think that's a kind of, and I think the question you alluded to is a very interesting one, which is like, is it, because in some sense, both you and I, are enthusiasts for building. So, you know, I've devoted the last 5 years of my life obsessively to memorize. And, you know, you've produced a wonderful, like, collection of books and amusing and rich perspectives which you've shared with other people, and you know, you've enriched a lot of people's lives, no doubt, and you know, that seems inherently meritorious, right? It seems like that's got to be like a good thing to be doing, to be trying to do something, right? But on the other hand, like, you know, if nobody was trying to do things, what would that be so bad? Or if everyone like tried to do quarter as much? There's a great book by Bertrand Russell called In Praise of Idleness.
Oh, it's a great essay. Yeah,
and he's got this great quote in there, which is like, workers of two kinds: moving objects at or near the Earth's surface, or telling other people to do so. The first is ill-paid and unpleasant. The second is, you know, great fun and rather well remunerated. And anyway, that kind of concept of moving objects at or near the Earth's surface, you'd have to update for the present day to like moving information at or near the Earth's surface.
Yeah.
Anyway, in that essay, he's like, well, you know, a kind of classic economic insight, I guess, which is that, you know, we can make stuff twice as efficient and work half as much, or we can make stuff twice as efficient and work the same amount and make. and it's not clear to me that that making stuff twice as efficient and then working the same amount is the correct response.
Agreed. Well, Ed, I'd love to ask you a couple of bite-sized questions. I know that it's. Mm-hmm. I want to let you get to your proper Friday evening, since I've kind of got you under lock and key. Yep. Here in the office. So I'd like to unleash you upon the world, but I'd love to ask you a couple of fast questions, and you can feel free to elaborate. But I'll try to. I'd love to sort of hit you with a couple of these before we come to a close. The first is one I don't usually ask, but I have to ask because you've used the words press up, which is push up for you Yanks listening, and other things. For instance, what is the one stereotypically British thing that Americans should really appreciate or might get enjoyment of?
That's a good question. I think
I love the ka-ching. Was that a toaster?
That's a new subscription, Tim.
Oh, nice. All right, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. It was kind of comedy in the office, but I think the because I've lived a bunch in Boston when I did textiles there, and I was here in America, and the thing which always kind of really impresses and amazes me about Americans, and which by contrast is different in the British people, is that British people are like fundamentally embarrassed about the expression of intention. That it's almost like there's something like fundamentally vulgar in human, in British life. I suppose human life, British life. It's like American calling baseball the World Series. But anyway, there's something fundamentally embarrassing about stating intentions. And what's so liberating about Coming to America is that that embarrassment doesn't exist. But at the same time, going back to Britain, it's this terribly beautiful thing. And I kind of think it's kind of connected a lot to British humor. Which is this basic kind of consciousness of the absurdity of trying combined with actually still trying.
What is a good gateway drug for British comedy for people who for real dyed in the wool Americans who perhaps I've seen some British humor I have a lot of trouble with. I just can't quite figure it out. And then there's other British humor or British-ish humor like Shaun of the Dead, which I find completely hilarious. so what is a good gateway drug if you had to pick one entry point?
Gateway? Why are you asking me about gateway? Can't you just ask me what I think is pure genius?
Sure. Okay. All right. I'll let you upgrade my question. What is pure genius? I just don't want it to be pearls before swine. I want the to educate, and I'm throwing myself in that same
group.
Right.
You know, I think does the thick of it exist in America? Is there a kind of American version of it? Well, my favorite comedian is a guy called Armando Iannucci. So Armando, and then Iannucci is IANNUCCI. And he had this show called The Armando Iannucci Show, which actually I think was a failure even on British TV. So this might not be brilliant for a gateway drug. And I think part of the reason for that is that he's actually not a terribly charismatic performer. He's just an absolutely brilliant writer and conceiver of comedy. But the Armando Iannucci show was had a brief appearance on British TV and somehow captured both like a wicked love of life and an absolute horror at everything which is going on through a kind of completely incoherently absurdist humor. So, for instance, I'm trying to think of a good example, but for instance, there was one sketch which involves a guy driving his car really fast, where at a very, very specific miles per hour, about 157 miles an hour, he enters into a flawless state of perfect meditative perfection, where he doesn't have to make any decisions. He just avoids all pedestrians and just disappears, but then has to get back down to 0 miles an hour without killing people. Another one begins with a cityscape, where you see all the lights coming on in the morning. And with each light, you hear the audio of the person screaming about the futility of their existence. As the narrator says, this man designs bacon packaging for a living. This person is in charge of Bedford's water supply. Oh God, this is the manager of Bewitched. Bastards, I hate it. You know, this. sorry, I'm.
It's very like Kierkegaard.
Yeah, that's such a poor advertisement for a genius comic. It's always a bit tricky. But I'd recommend to your original question, what's a good gateway? I think Monty Python's a great gateway still. Because you can't help but be delighted by their kind of cheeky enthusiasm, even as you're just tuning in to the humor. Mm-hmm. And then in contemporary thing, there's a thing called Alan Partridge, which is sort of written by Armando Iannucci as well, which is the story of a radio DJ from Norfolk, who is actually has shadows of like David Brent from The Office, but in a kind of richer, more amusing fashion, and it's his sort of trials and tribulations. So Alan Partridge would be my gateway drug.
Perfect.
You're really looking for a one-line answer there.
No, I love it. You have one of the most colorful vocabularies and cadences of anyone I know. So I love your emails. I was going to actually read the sequence of emails that you had recently, where you introduced me to one of your friends, now a mutual friend. Where most people are like, Joe meet John meet Joe. Take it from here. You create these wonderfully. I'm not going to say they're not antiquated. That's not the word that I'm looking for. But they're very. They read like a Civil War love letter or something. they're so eloquent, and I'm like, God damn! Like this guy. I wonder if the amount of effort you expend on that is the amount of effort that I would have to expend to create such a thing, because you're very prosaic and very entertaining in that way. Is what did your parents do, if you don't mind me asking, professionally?
So my dad was a coder, actually. He refused to teach me to code, by the way, because he thought I should play in the garden, which I still vaguely resent, but you know, I did enjoy playing in the garden. And my mum was a sort of teacher. I guess I did have an interesting education, because I was in we lived near Oxford, and I ended up going to a school which had lots of Oxford academics' children in it, and I was part of a class. You know, maybe I was quite good at my subjects. I was part of a class where the other people in this class were just sort of this amazingly colourful bunch of precociously intellectual characters. And so I guess I did have a bit of that. I still kind of laugh about the kind of situation that represented, but because it was in many respects quite unhealthy.
Why was that unhealthy?
Well, I don't think it's good to peak intellectually at the age of 13. and I think that
do you think a lot of them did, or do you think that it was
I think that it was actually quite a magical time, and it was I think that it's quite rare in life to be surrounded by people who challenge you and who like you.
Yeah, for sure.
And so it's quite a great experience. It's a wonderful experience to have. But like, I think a lot of the people who are in that situation in the school then went off to other schools, you know, a variety of other schools where that didn't exist. And so they ended up being all of us ended up in some sense being quite nostalgic at the age of 14. So just to give you an example, our favorite film as a group in our teenagers was With Nell and I. I don't know if you've seen With Nell and I, but it's a...
Say that again?
Have you seen the film With Nell and I?
No. With Nail?
Oh, my God.
With
Nail.
Space, N-A-I-L?
No, it's actually, it's like all one word, With Nail. So it's the name of a character in this film. So this is your gateway drug to British humor.
All right.
What's With Nail and I? So it's basically a film about some washed up actors, but full of passion, struggling their way on a kind of comedy road trip in their late 20s.
I feel like every... like Netflix description of British comedy just makes me want to slip my wrists before I even get started. Oh my God. Yeah. But yes, With Nell and I.
With Nell, oh yeah, please watch With Nell and I, because it's basically a film made out of fragments of insanely quotable bits and bobs. I mean, it's intensely funny, incredibly romantic, and kind of like a profound narrative, I guess, about what it's like to have high hopes for life and then discover that it's not quite as easy as you think. Anyway, it's so charming. It's so, and you know, it's about friendship and so it's a really wonderful film. Anyway, but it's also very nostalgic. I'd say. So, but you know, really, it's not a healthy age of 14. It's like, oh gosh, I remember when I was 13, everything was so good. We used to use words like portentous, but now I just say spoon.
What now? Aside from, it sounds like you had, intellectually stimulating schooling experience at that point. What can you think of a specific defining moment of your childhood? Is there anything that stands out in terms of forming you into the person you are today?
I can't think of something which I could honestly report as like a causal factor, but I do have a couple of favorite childhood memories. One of which was, which I think is like, it's like, this is like, this memory is something which I would, if I was held hostage and someone was about to delete this memory, I would pay, if I had them, hundreds of thousands of dollars to not delete. Because it was a moment in my childhood, maybe I was five, in the garden, looking out at some trees in the distance. And for whatever reason, with my dad, I was discussing basically visual perception, but seeing. And he was saying, I must have been commenting on, I don't know how it began, but he was saying, oh, the light bounces off the trees and goes into your eyes. And I found this incredibly confusing. And I was like, no, but my eyes go out and touch the trees, that my vision goes out and touches the trees. And he was like, no, the photons bounce off the tree or from the sun and they enter your eye, and that's how you come up with a picture. And I was like, and I remember just intensely the weirdness of the confusion. And I remember getting to a point where I was happy to accept that my vision reached out to the halfway point to meet the light in between me and the trees. And but I just couldn't even conceive of how perception could be passive. And anyway, I bumped into this thing years later when studying psychology, where a lecturer mentioned the theory of an Arabic psychologist and philosopher called, I'm not sure if I can remember his name, but like Al-Hazen, I think his name is. And Al-Hazen was a guy who in the 12th century or something disproved the theory of exteroception, which apparently was really popular until like the year 1200, the theory that your eye went out and met the world rather than your eye just sits there passively and receives information. And then the second thing which amplified this memory, you know, beyond the family connection and just the preciousness of the virgin perspective on the world, was that when I got intensely into the philosophy of perception as an undergraduate, I got into this guy called Maurice Merleau-Ponty, who's a kind of poetic, super cool, cigarette-smoking French philosopher who writes beautiful prose. And he has this theory of perception where the activity is given back to perception, not because vision goes out spatially, but because perception is this active, probing, question-asking activity involving like a profound resonance between you and the world, which is so far away from neuroscience as it's normally thought of, where it's all like input, processing, representation, experience. This was this really much more beautiful and I'll come back to this in a second, but much more true to experience theory of perception, which is that we're in this kind of dialogue or resonance with the world where our brains and the world kind of owed a resonance, which means that our brain changes and then the meaning of the stuff in the world is altered. And it's a bit like dancing with somebody. You know, there's input, there's output, but it's the pattern between you which makes the most sense in the end, which is what's actually happening. And so to wheel that back, the core memory is incredible because it describes a naivety of perception which you can never get back. You can never perceive the world with such a stupid idea of how perception works. But at the same time, you can never actually experience perception devoid of the concepts we have for what's happening to it. And the second thing is that it's true. That's what it feels like to perceive. And we suppress that. So that's my favorite childhood memory. It actually only became significant later on, but I love it.
Well, let me touch on some of the aspects of perception that you brought up. I think you and I, and if you're not comfortable talking about this, let me know. But I believe you and I were chatting when we had some wine, many moons ago in San Francisco about effectively augmented synesthesia. So using hardware, if I'm mixing people up, let me know. But using hardware to see smells or have this type of commingling of the senses and perception. Could you talk about that for a second? I don't know where that went or where it was, but if you could explain what you were doing, I think people would find it very interesting.
Well, yeah. So after I give a bit of biography, I'll be as quick as possible here, but I went to study under a guy called Kevin O'Regan in Paris. And Kevin O'Regan, I had encountered when I was right up to my final exams at university. I was in this intense period of study, partly because I'd been drunk most of the rest of the time. And so I had to really ram it in. And so all these kind of ideas were new in my mind and they're fusing together. And I discovered this paper by this guy, Kevin O'Regan, which was in Behavioral and Brain Sciences and was called A Sensory Motor Theory of Visual Perception. And in it, he quoted a series of the most wonderful, obscure experiments from psychology, one of which was this tactile visual substitution device created by a guy called Paul Bach E. Rita. Bach like the composer, Y like and in Spanish, Rita like lovely Rita. Paul Bach E. Rita. And he was building devices for the blind to see through touch. So the tactile visual stimulation system, TVSS, basically would take a camera on your glasses and would transform that visual input into basically a highly pixelated sort of 100 by 100 array of vibrating pins you could hold against your back or your thigh or your leg or wherever there was a nice surface on your body to touch. And the fascinating thing about this device is if someone else is holding the camera and you have this, it just feels like random, totally patternless scratching. And when you are wearing the glasses and you first touch it to your skin, it also feels like that. But when you move around, you begin to track the correspondences between movement and sensation. And to cut a long story short, eventually you end up short-circuiting all the noise and you actually perceive through touch a visual-like experience of space before you. So you feel looming objects. You see things going past the side. You feel things approaching as you go to them. And you have a feeling of space. And the feeling of space is based not on input, which is now like a totally different form of input, but on the patterns and connections between your movement and the sensations which arise. And so this is like an incredibly profound thing about the nature of consciousness, which is, roughly speaking, Kevin's theory, which I basically roughly believe, is that the quality of experience is like the pattern of movements you're able to make and the expected consequences of those movements. And so his metaphor was, if you're holding a bottle of wine in your hand, as I am now, by the way, and I've nearly finished it, but if you're holding a bottle of wine, you're only touching, you have your eyes closed, you're only touching part of the bottle of wine, but you kind of feel the rest of it, even though you're not feeling it. You know that if you move your hand upwards, it's not like it couldn't be a tube or just like a little blocky sphere or something, even though the touch would be the same. Your perceptual experience extends beyond the current input and it's based in expectation. Okay. So that's the preamble. And as a result of that, I ended up doing a PhD, trying to do a PhD in philosophy of perception, where the output that year was to consider what the difference between color and smell is. And to do that, I kind of did what that tactile visual substitution system in a way describes the difference between touch and vision, because it says touch feels totally different. But actually, if touch is given the same sensory motor patterns as vision, it begins to feel like vision. So you can experience vision through touch by the patterns of interaction. And so I tried to come up with a theory of how color and smell feel like they do, and my God, they feel mysterious. You know, you smell cinnamon. What connection does that have with reality? You see any color, and particularly a beautiful, rich color, you know, the azure blue of a morning sky or green or whatever, of a kind of rainforest canopy. And it feels like inherently weird. Like, what is the connection between your experience, this rich, intangible emotion in a way, and reality? It's very easy with vision, because you're like, oh, the glass looks round, it is round. You know, it's a very kind of military connection. But with color, you're like, wow, that orange. I'm just looking at a kind of the blinking light of an orange computer here. And actually, you tune into the orange, it's like, what the hell fucking relationship does that have to atoms bumping around space? It seems like a totally different kind of quality. So anyway, Scott, I couldn't tell this anecdote any longer. Sorry, Tim. Sorry, listeners. But if anyone's still here, about 7 hours. But anyway, so
if anyone is still listening, I'm just going to interrupt. This is something that Kevin Rose, buddy of mine, pulled on me. If anyone is still listening to this podcast, please let us know what you think. Shoot me or Ed a note on Twitter and put hashtag EdEdGoodGood. This is an inside joke from a long time ago to let us know. But Ed, please continue.
Yeah, at Ted Cook on Twitter, by the way.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you know, and so the thought experiment I came up with was like, let's imagine you see in black and white. So your basic vision is black and white. And then when you look at what is in fact in reality a green object, you experience a particular smell, say the smell of whatever, leaves. Mm-hmm. And then you look at what is a blue object and you experience the smell of a fresh sea wind or something like that. So arbitrary connections between things. But the first question was like, could you experience those as qualities of the object? And the answer I came up with was basically, well, of course you would, because you know, when I currently look at an orange object, I'm just spatially looking at it, and then I'm having the experience of orange, and I look away and I cease having the experience of orange, and I look back and I have the experience of orange. And so if that orange was being kind of put into my head by an evil goblin who just gave me the orange feeling every time I looked at the, in fact, orange hammock, which I was seeing in black and white, well, then I would experience that color as being, which the color is just in fact a smell or a sound, it could be, on the object. So the connection between movement I address with my perceptual organs. I look at the hammock, and suddenly it's going jing, 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 jing. Look away, it ceases to do that. I look back at it, jing, 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 jing. I look away, it ceases to do that. After like doing that a million times, you wouldn't think that the sound was coming from any other place than the surface of the object.
Right.
And I'm still of the kind of somewhat smug, completely incoherent opinion that this is actually quite a fundamental insight into into like the mystery of sensations, which is that we attribute to the cause of the sensation everything which comes with it emotionally and da da da, and we kind of project is actually a poor word, but it's an easy one to relate to. We kind of project those onto the surface of the object when in some sense they come from us. Mm-hmm. It's just that when we look at the object, they're there. And, you know, in a way, this kind of goes back to the chats we were having earlier about our relationships with other people and even situations and aspects of ourselves, which is that when we think about a particular thing, if all the things that evokes in us are only evoked by that thing, we think that is a characteristic of the thing, not of our interaction with the thing or person.
No, I love this. I want to ask you, have you experimented with removing different types of sensory input, going a period of time without sight, going a period of time without hearing, anything like that?
I have occasionally done, yeah, little games like that. Not to the heroic extent of a mathematician called Seymour Papert, who trained himself to look through mirrors so the world was up, down, reversed for like months at a time, so that it kind of righted itself. But anyway, I have had an experience when I was, I have had an experience with friends where you walk around town blindfolded, led by another person. Mm-hmm. And that is so cool. So you just get a good friend, someone you trust, and say, I'm going to be blindfolded, or you're going to be blindfolded, and I'm just going to lead you around town. And that's magic, because you can have the experience of perceiving the world, not visually, but just through sound. And, you know, it's fun in the obvious sense, but it's also like, oh, wow, Like, I actually can perceive the wealthy sound, and what's more, I perceive it in a different, but in many ways richer fashion. since occasionally you're citing some cool books, there's a book called Touching the Rock, and I don't know if I can remember the guy's name, but by John something or other, Holt, perhaps, John Holt. But Touching the Rock, Google it. And it's the story of a guy who goes blind very, very gradually for 20 years and then finally becomes completely blind. And many interesting things about it, one of which is that he says that the difference between having a tiny crack of indeterminate light and nothing was as big as the difference between indeterminate light and full vision, because suddenly he was just in the abyss.
Right.
And there was just no visual connection. But the second thing is kind of like that he's kind of a theologian, but he has this wonderful reflections on how he came to enjoy the world being blind. And one go-to example is that rain is the best thing for blind people, because you can hear the world in three dimensions, because the pattering of the raindrops on the roofs and the pavement, the lampposts and the buildings gives you, because of the echo and because of the particular, it gives you a sense of 3D space, where most of the time your 3D space only goes like a couple of yards in front of you, and otherwise it's just the void. Stuff like that, which are kind of cool way games for just enjoying your senses generally.
So and fascinating. So, like, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, so I was just thinking that, you know, for anyone who's endured this long, that would be a kind of, I think, quite a valuable recommendation. It's like, you know, drawing a few things together, you know, next time there's due to be a rainstorm, rather than thinking like, oh no, I'm not going to be able to go to Santa Cruz and sun myself or something, think like, get one of your best friends, go out in the rain, blindfold them, and allow them to perceive through the magic of hearing the world in all its mysterious awesomeness via audition.
Oh, it's a brilliant suggestion. I also wonder, you know, at what point will we see, and it could be done a couple of different ways technologically, but people using, let's just say blind people using something like an Oculus Rift, or it wouldn't necessarily be an Oculus Rift, could just be some type of device that's attached where you can upload very accurate, you know, to the centimeter mapping, mm-hmm. 3D mapping of the world around them, let's just say in a 10-mile radius, or there could be some device for sensing all of this that provides them with auditory feedback or other types of feedback that tells them exactly where they are. And what this makes me think of, there's one of my favorite articles I've read in the last 10 years is an article in Men's Journal. I just looked it up. People can Google the blind man who taught himself to see. And it's about Daniel Kish, K-I-S-H. And he's been sightless since he was a year old. He can mountain bike. He can navigate the wilderness alone. He can recognize a building as far away as 1,000 feet. I'm just kind of reading the subtitle here. But he does it through echolocation, the same way that bats find their way around. He has the ability to click in a very, very methodical, precise way to determine exactly where things are and where he is. And I'll just give people a teaser with the first paragraph, because this entire piece blew my mind. And the first paragraph is, the first thing, this is the author speaking, Michael Finkel. The first thing Daniel Kish does when I pull up to his tidy gray bungalow in Long Beach, California, is make fun of my driving. "You're going to leave it that far from the curb?" he asks. He's standing on his stoop a good 10 paces from my car. I glance behind me as I walk up. I am indeed parked about a foot and a half from the curb. I mean, it's just so amazing. So amazing.
Yeah.
And it also raises questions for me about, you know, when you just mentioned touching the rock, and the difference between having just a glimmer of light perception and none, how much of a phase shift it is often for people who will use psychedelics, for instance, or mushrooms, and the difference between the sort of normal resolution at which we view the world and then the one step removed moving upwards, where we have almost an enhanced HD perception of the world, and mm-hmm. and how significantly that changes your perception of everything. And you're seeing everything with new eyes, even though it's really just one click of the dial in terms of resolution. So fascinating. Well, we have a lot to talk about. I want to let you get to your night. You've been very generous with your time, and I always enjoy rapping with you.
It's a pleasure, Tim. Really fun. On that point, by the way, there's a, just to sort of pile up the reading list, there's Alan Watts, who's quite a kind of cheerful and wide-ranging and amusing kind of 20th century philosopher, hallucinogen taker, that I think he described himself as a sort of spiritual entertainer. But he wrote a essay called The Joyous Cosmology, which examines in quite fascinating ways a little bit the, I guess, what you call the phenomenology of hallucination, where he talks about exactly that, like, how it's even possible that perception can become much higher resolution and what it means that it is possible. And so, because I, for instance, as anyone else, I think, considers like the resolution of my perception to be a function of my perceptual organs and brain. And it's not an easily accessible idea that I could perceive at twice the resolution basically by paying more attention. Yeah. And so he's quite magic on this subject. And, he talks about hallucination as a terrible term for the phenomenon, because hallucination implies distortion and unreality, whereas this is hyper-reality, as he describes it. So that's well worth a read, The Joyous Cosmology by Alan Watts.
I love it. Ed, where can people find more about you, what you're up to, on the internets or otherwise?
Well, in Hackney, in the non-internets, I hang out. So come to Hackney and then get into it. But yeah, I'm memrise.com is worth a look. We have a website and an app, and we're trying to make learning joyful. If you're really into the questions about phenomenology and stuff, about the quality of experience, there's an ask which can be found online called "Is Trilled Smell Possible?"
Is what smell possible?
Trilled, in the sense of the musical note going.
Right. Is trilled smell possible?
Which is definitely like, it's probably one of the worst, most incoherent pieces ever published in a philosophy journal, but it's quite good. And I'm at Ted Cook on Twitter.
And that is Ed Cook with an E at the end for exceptional. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Although actually on Twitter, I'm Ted Cook because some twat had taken Ed Cook.
You're at Ted Cook, really, with a T in the
at
beginning?
Ted Cook. Yeah. Timmy, you're not following me. Jesus Christ.
I know. I should be following you. I have all this goodness. Yeah. I'm in a bit of social media malaise. I have a bit of digital fatigue, so I've been taking a break of sorts to the extent that I do. I will let you get to your evening and your weekend. Thanks so much for jumping on. And
hey, this has been a pleasure, Tim.
Really fun. So we will grab some wine and get into some trouble next time you're in San Francisco.
Impeccable. See you soon, Tim.
All right, thanks, Ed. Bye. Okay.
Ciao.
This episode of The Tim Ferriss Show is brought to you by 99 Designs. 99 Designs is the world's largest online marketplace of graphic designers. And I have used 99 Designs for years, including to get cover concepts for The 4-Hour Body, which went on to become number one New York Times, number one Wall Street Journal. It was a huge hit. And here's how it works. And you can check everything out, including some of my competitions. You can see these book covers and so on at 99designs.com/Tim. Whether you need a logo, a car wrap, a web design, an app, a thumbnail, a t-shirt, whatever, you go to 99designs.com. You describe your project, and then within a week or less, you have tons of designers around the world who compete for your business and submit different ideas and designs and drafts. You have an original design that you love, or you pay nothing. It is fantastic. I have used it. I have mentioned it before, including in the 4-Hour Workweek as a resource. Check it out, 99designs.com/Tim. And if you use that link, you'll be able to see what I've done on the platform. You will also get $99 as an upgrade for free, which will get you more designs, more submissions. So check it out. And until next time, thank you for listening.
Why?
If you have T-Mobile 5G home internet, you might be hearing this a lot.
Why?
Every time your internet slows down during the busiest hours.
Why?
Why?
Because your network gives priority to cell phone users.
Why?
Good question. Why not switch to Cox Internet with 2x faster download speeds than T-Mobile 5G home internet during peak hours?
Okay.
Stop the whys and visit cox.com/5G home for details. T-Mobile prioritizes certain T-Mobile phone users over home internet users during times of congestion.